Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. And welcome. Thanks for joining us. This is, I believe, Kirk, this is our 372 episode. I looked it up after our last one to figure out where we were and the count. And I didn't have a convenient way to detail out how many we've done. We're close to 100, I think, you and I. Maybe 75 to 100 episodes.
Wow.
And
I know you've done a lot. You've probably done 90% of the episodes, haven't you? I think you've had a couple times. You've had guests, two people, one of us doing, like me and Ryan Wenger did and the podcast about, or the reliability of pinball machines.
That's right. And that was a good show. I enjoyed it.
It was a great show.
You should do some more of those. And I know Adam's done and a few others have done some, but it's,
right.
Yeah, and I'm trying to just keep the schedule going. So it's, I'm waiting for you guys to do more of them, but yeah, come on, let's go.
Well, we like talking with you, Fred.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're one of the central, I mean, you've started Accendo Reliability. You have the Node MTBF website. I think you're the one to have, you know, taken up a lot of the social media and kind of cornered the market on, especially with Accendo, kind of gathering information about reliability as a central site and central source. And so that's a great accomplishment I think you've had over the 4 years that we've known each other and done these podcasts. So and you know I have posted a few blogs on there. You've put a lot of written material. So for those who are listening, if you haven't explored the Accendo website, you ought to check it out because there's plenty of Speaking of Reliability podcasts that Fred and I've done, and also other people in the group. And it's a lot of good information. I think we've covered just about everything we can think about with the reliability, and we'll continue to cover it.
Yeah.
But lot of hours. How many hours is that? That's probably
370 shows, and they're about 25 minutes each. So over a couple hundred, over 100 hours easily of recordings. And you know, and we talked about it last time in the last episode, is that when we started, we didn't know if we'd have enough to talk about. But getting questions from people and through the Accendo site or through our LinkedIn connections and so on, often provides us that little gem of a question or an idea or something to talk about. Now, to be fair, the folks that contact us, we tend to try to, we answer the question as best we can right away. Oh, and before I forget, Kirk.
Yes.
I got a bone to pick with you. I mean, you mentioned all the articles. Thanks for the plug of the site. is your article, the drain in the bathtub curve, I think it's called. You should link to that in the show notes. Continues to be one of the top articles on the NoMTBF site. It just is, and I think we also have it on Accendo. It's getting traction. It continues to be found and read, you know, and it's one of those things that and you're probably tired of me telling you this, but you need to write more because you do have a really good voice in the writing part. So I'll take that discussion offline and try to
thank you, Fred.
Cover that.
And I'm glad to hear that because the point of that article is that, you know, it really is for most electronics that the technological obsolescence comes well before most semiconductors and other components actually reach a wear out mode. So I encourage everybody, we'll put a link to that. But that is a key point about in the history of reliability that I think has been missed. And as we all have, you know, VCRs, video cassette recorders sitting around that, you know, and I just, one of the things I pointed out to you that I've purchased a pinball machine. It has 30-year-old circuit boards in it, and they're doing fine.
Right.
All the chips, I don't question for a moment that those chips have reached a wear out mode.
Oh, no. You're probably more concerned about the elasticity of the bumpers.
Right. In fact, I ordered a set of new rubber bands and bumpers and all that because, they do wear out. And mechanics, the coils, the solenoids for the flippers and those kinds of things, they have friction in them. They will wear out. So that's certainly. But we were going to talk about, I think, the issue of field failures.
Yeah, that's right.
How we treat those.
That's right.
And so that's a key to the whole reliability issue. That is the most fundamental thing. You first have to reproduce and verify a failure.
No, Kirk. First thing you have to do is not have any. The best practice is from
that's
a Dilbert.
Best practice.
You know, is the best practice is don't have any field failures. And
right.
If they do happen to occur, the second best practice, and this is according to Dogbert on the Dilbert cartoon series, is blame the customer. it's your fault it failed. You have to pay for it.
That's right. Didn't the customer know that plug was not keyed, was supposed to go in this way or
not that
something?
Way? You're not supposed to do that. And, some products and some companies actually follow that advice is they make it. You call them to get support, and the phone tree takes 45 minutes, and it basically hangs up on you six times. And then they finally get to you, and after hearing, your call is very important to us. Please hold for the next available agent, I think I actually wrote an article years ago about the trouble I was having with one particular customer service event. Mm-hmm. It took 3 months. And it drove me nuts. When a field failure occurs, and you're right, Kirk, I'm being a little facetious, but the good practice is that's information. That's gold. It's like the customer just ran a halt test for you and told maybe they did or maybe they didn't. Our daughters certainly do that with phones. They overstress them quite a bit.
Right.
But now you've got information that you can learn from. If customers just go away and don't buy your product anymore, that's a total loss. You've lost them probably for good, right? But if they took the time to say, hey, look, I really like your product. I like the features. I want it to work. Right. I'm a little disappointed here. It's not working. I want my money back or I want a replacement or whatever.
Right.
They are defining what you need to pay attention to, right? Because this is the failures.
Right.
And then once you get it in the door, right? And we've talked about it before, is for some products, there's barriers to getting it back. The customer says, it failed, I'll throw it away. And they don't even tell you, right? They might go buy you the same one again, or they might buy somebody else's. Other higher price point ones, they say, well, is it in warranty or not? And they'll try to get it covered, the quasi-insurance policy, and others go through repair centers, like a washing machine. You might call the repairman, and they may or may not report that back to the vendor, the manufacturer.
Right. And, of course, one of the challenges, and we've talked about the amount of what we call C&D, cannot duplicate or
trouble found.
Reproduce it, when you bring it back to the factory.
Right.
There's many factors that make that really challenging. Ideally, if you could, as soon as the customer says it's not working, if you could fly out to their location, see how they're operating the machine, see what they're doing, how they're turning it on, what they're doing to,
IBM
if it's programmable
used to do
or
that.
Something. Ideally, that because that's where you could say, "Oh, you didn't push this button, or you didn't turn on this switch, or something like that." And it's just it's not necessarily the product's not functioning; is the customer doesn't know how to use it, or it uses it incorrectly.
Well, there are products like that. I know in the medical device field, especially for the more expensive ones that are complicated devices, they generally will have a field tech there for like a week or 2 weeks on initial training and use and care. And if there's a problem that they have regions and they fly out or drive to that site and troubleshoot. Most of the time their focus is on getting it to work. And the secondary feature is, well, what failed? And so they're not there to troubleshoot and get it working.
No.
Whatever the issue is, and it might be just knowledge of how to use it and what to expect. You're exactly right.
Right. I used to work on semiconductor production equipment. And of course that, you know, I couldn't, you know, you use a shotgun technique. You replace three parts like everybody does, because that's the most likely area of, that's causing the failure. Now, which one of those three subcomponents or subsystems actually the failure is a whole effect after you've repaired it, that you may or may not be able to send those parts back. And once you send them back to the original manufacturer or, you know, the supplier, it may be the interaction of the parts or something to do with the tolerances.
Yeah, or a connector that you reseated with the new part going in. You know, two of the three or all three will probably be no trouble found. You know,
right, exactly, by the nature of, right, one of them's a failed part. So you inherently, because of the nature of especially in expensive equipment or critical equipment, getting it back online is the most important thing. That you're kind of also the fireman that's all, you know, put out the fire, and you're the hero, and everything after that is not as rewarded necessarily.
That's right.
As lauded as you, hey, you got this $1 million iron implanter back online. We appreciate that. And you feel relieved, and then going to the extra work of shipping everything back, or, you know, is kind of a, okay, that's more minor to the field engineer.
Well, it sets up this dynamic, though, in that circumstance that you were in, Kirk, is that it might not be written down, it might not be the policy, yet the structure of it sets you up to go, well, if I help the design team solve this problem, it's such that I never get called out to go fix it again, I'm not the hero anymore. I'm not the lauded one. I'm not the expert that saved the day.
You're saying there's a conflict of interest in being the hero?
Yeah. And I think that's true across so many different places. So you never got a bonus because you identified a design flaw and it got solved and you never got called to fix that thing again.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You didn't get paid for that.
Right. And they didn't know, they didn't know that, or you couldn't prove to them that was going to be a field failure.
That's right.
Okay. If you fix it before, it's like,
yeah, if you fix it and it doesn't fail, did the tree really crash? You know,
right?
You know, it's that kind of problem.
It's very rare, but I have had, you know, one customer was shipping a product for 2 years, and then tried Halt and Haas, and I mean, asked me to come in and show them how to apply that to this product, and it dropped 90% from a 5% annual return rate to a 0.5%, 0.5%.
It's amazing when you pay attention to failures.
Don't get that chance. You can't get that chance very often. No. So when they were using, then after that, of course, all their new products became subjected to Halt during development. So they found things and fixed them, and they didn't become field failures, but, you know, nobody was rewarded and said, well, that was a field failure. We knew that was, in some cases, that could be true, but a lot of times you don't see what doesn't
the customer's not complaining about. That's right. And that is a dilemma. And I think enlightened companies, but enlightened companies pay attention to that and go, you know, we are enjoying this 0.5% field failure rate. And it's because of this investment we do up front that it happens. And so it is important. It just becomes, it erodes though, it becomes commonplace.
Right, and it's difficult. You really have to have still in those situations a champion, because once you've fixed the major problems, you may, and if you're doing a, say, like a screening process like HAS, you may not have failures. I mean, you don't, you know, your screens don't find anything because your product's pretty robust and you fix most of the weaknesses.
Yeah.
And the only time you're going to catch something is one of your sub-suppliers has a problem, excursion, as they say, and causes your product to fail.
All right.
So you're making – it's like an insurance policy. You know, some people don't carry insurance and just, you know, hope the risk of something coming along is not there. HAS is an expensive insurance policy. And I would say that after the initial learning curve of early production and the pilot and early production, it might – certainly needs to be examined that if it's cost effective at
that
time.
That's right. And move it upstream into your supply chain is, you know, do
right,
other things.
Suppliers to do things.
All right. So let's talk about yet another best practice. Here, air quotes here. All right. You get a product in, you put it on the bench, and you have a technician looks at it and he goes, all right, well, is it power up? Does it do basic functional tests? And oftentimes this is in an operations or manufacturing facilities, right? It, for whatever reason, I mean, they got the facilities, they got the space, they have the diagnostic tools. They're closer to that actual design because the design team's off on the next project kind of thing.
Right, right.
And so they get it and they look at it and go, okay, there's nothing wrong with this product.
And that's very, very common, unfortunately.
Right. So then
they have nothing to do, right? They don't have anything to improve on it or fix if they can't reproduce the failure, verify what the customer was complaining of.
But your comment though about design teams that looked at in implementing HALT and shaking out their, no pun intended, shaking out their designs and finding failures earlier. I know you've had this experience. Is that if you take that field return that on first pass as no trouble found. And sometimes just heating it up a little bit or putting it under even moderate stress reveals cracked solder joints or loose components or faulty connectors or things that in use by the customer show this intermittent failure. And on your bench, it's benign. It's just room temperature. It's just fine.
And I did have the chance to apply that idea to – I went to – the quality department and this computer company and their portable computers, two of them were having a problem that the customer was complaining about. They were actually from different locations in the world, I think. And they had been on the bench for 5 days running, test cycles and self-test and rebooting. They couldn't find anything wrong. And I had a chamber that I was running thermal cycling in with a bunch of similar portable computers, and I put it in the. I put these two units in the chamber, and the customer, the supplier had said, or the OEM that produced them, said that they couldn't have. They didn't find anything after 5 days on the bench. After 1 day of thermal cycling from minus 10 to plus 65, both of these computers locked up and showed the blue screen of death. That was an indication of the problem that the customer was reporting.
The customer was not cycling from minus 10 to plus 65.
No.
Yeah,
no,
they weren't stable at 20 degrees, right?
But stimulating them a little bit and stressing them thermally with the, you change the timings of the chips, you change some of the interactions, the speed of the, just slightly. But that's what you're talking about. If it doesn't, fail on the bench, but is failing customer occasionally, intermittently, then you're talking about a slight variation that is right on the edge of operation, but pushing it by electrical voltage margining, by thermal stress, and sometimes vibration where a component is adjacent or there's a cracked solder joint and you can stimulate it to be an open circuit, then you have something, you found it. But a lot of times that costs money. I mean, it does take to have units go through a thermal chamber or things after the fact. Just taking apart a product is a cost. Some companies, the product, if it's a $5 power supply, you're adding $10 of course, you're not realizing, or a lot of companies don't realize, the value of finding the root cause of the failure.
That's right.
Much more this, but you have to make that effort, and they say, oh, no, it's too low cost. We'll just give them another one, and yet they just keep sending out, the same parts. A lot of times they're sending good parts out after getting good parts in.
That's right.
Because they don't –
it's a trade-off there, and every company has to face it is, well, what's your – customer facing service. How are you going to stand behind your product and for whatever reason? And every company deals with that slightly differently. And that's fine. That's part of doing business.
Right.
But the
after the fact.
Yeah. It's a missed opportunity that when you get something back, I mean, if you really are only focused on hardware failures, you put it on the bench and try to run it, or throw it in a chamber and find that it has this problem or doesn't, you may be missing a bigger picture, I think, of was it just the wrong color, or was it a miss in the feature set that this customer was expecting, or did they misorder? It's a corporate client and they ordered 12, but they really only wanted 10 and they shipped it back under warranty and got a full refund. Is it a sales error? Was it a typo and we shipped them the wrong thing?
Yeah, right? Was it an old revision of the software that they downloaded and accidentally put in there or something? You know?
So I'm expanding my scope of what a reliability engineer does. It's not just that this capacitor broke, right? And we have a manufacturing error, or we have a problem with the physical product itself or the software.
Right.
Right. Reliability is that the customer sent it back and it costs us money. Let's make that stop. And sometimes it's not the design, right? Now, sometimes it is, but you really need to find out. And benign tests and putting it on the bench or throwing it away and ignoring it are often not enough. You're just not learning enough. So dealing with the failure analysis, but failure analysis is an open box at the start of, what led to this failure? What's the root cause? And sometimes the root cause is our warranty policy is so open that if Best Buy orders a pallet too many, they can ship it back as a full pallet under warranty and get full refund.
Yeah.
Right. And I actually saw that happen. Yeah.
Right.
So you got to go and talk to marketing and sales and all these other agencies that are dealing with why products come back. If we're setting the wrong expectation, we say this product works underwater and it doesn't work underwater, it's not necessarily the design was bad, is that the expectation of where it could be used was wrong, right? So either we make the product work underwater or we stop telling customers to go swimming with it.
Right.
Right.
In fact, it works really underwater, beyond the level that a human could survive, in my opinion, so that you know that even the ones that are not as sealed are going to be capable of, say, depth to 30 feet, something like that. So,
Well, that might be a subject for a whole nother one, is how you test water, because there's so many problems with how we evaluate products for water.
Right. Water's and reliability for a lot of products don't go together well.
I saw something awesome the other day. We need to wrap this up, but just real quick. Okay. The other day on LinkedIn, I'll see if I can find the link for it.
Okay.
There was a comedy bit that was put on. It was a spoof of office settings. And it says, we've had individual offices and cubicle offices and open space offices. The new trend is swimming pool offices. You get exercise, you have great support for your back and everything else. It's a little tough on electronics and they're pouring water out of the laptops. But with a little work, you can solve it. So they're putting shrink wrap around their computers and they're laminating all the paper. And
that's true.
And it just,
but with everybody working everywhere now, you do have to have some, laptops and office equipment that can withstand quite a variety. Certainly you see everybody out by the pool with their laptops a lot of times.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny. It's it was, done as a serious, this is the trend in office stuff, but it's a bit tongue-in-cheek as they went through it. It was hilarious as they went through it. And all these people are in office clothes, kind of hanging out in the pool in different in little office settings. They use the little noodles, I think they're called, the plastic
the little
polymer foam tubes kind of defining doorways and stuff, and they're swimming around, and it was just hilarious. It goes on and on and on.
But they are making products more durable and water resistant. I mean, obviously the phones, phone was never water resistant. Now the iPhone 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever.
It's ready for the pool based office. Yeah, it's ready to go.
It's ready for the dishwasher.
Yes. Well, let's not go that far.
Right, I'm not trying it.
So, good luck with your blenders experience there. You got a new record setter there. Yeah. That's all good. So you don't have to send that back.
Put a little hour meter on it and see how long it lasts.
That's right. That's right. Number of duty cycle, number of loads, little checklist next to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So maybe that would change field failures for good. If one of the best practices is that along with the return, you got to have documented use, you know, a little movie, YouTube videos of every time you use the blender and the whole history, a portfolio of use.
Right.
Of how it was used and when it was used and the incident of failure. If it's not on camera, we don't believe it.
If we could only do that, yes. The way a customer is using the product before they send it back. And it's difficult to get sometimes the detailed information because the customer is pretty ticked off at that time.
Well, they also might not know.
They might not know. They just want a new unit. They just want a unit that works. And so the easiest thing for the customer service engineer person on the phone is say, I'll send you a new one. Mm-hmm. And that kind of solves their problem right off the bat. And then that's when the rest of it de-escalates, you know, taking that back, and trying to find the real root cause and tying that to what the customer complaint is. Mm-hmm. It's a long, difficult, you know, it can be a long, difficult process.
And it's one worth doing though, right, Kirk? And you have to do it.
Right, right. And I say if a company doesn't know why their products are failing, before they start adding testing or anything else, they need to understand that and either stimulate the failure or go back up to the customer and see how they're using it. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be so much more valuable to them than just starting a halt test on the next product line.
That's right. That's right.
Something like that. Say, well, we're going to use these new techniques. Well, what are you applying it to? When I get a client, first thing I want to know is what their failure history on predecessor mm-hmm. products is and how much they know about the failures.
That's right.
A lot of times they don't. They don't know much about and they can't reproduce it. And that's saying that's your priority then. That's your high priority to find out the cause.
And that's the core of it is the failure analysis doesn't stop once you start production. You got to listen to your customers it's more difficult and it's invaluable. So with that, hopefully that addressed that question a little bit. And if you'd like to join the conversation and add a comment or a question that we'd talk about in one of the future shows, and we'll try to get an answer to you right away too, if it's something that we can answer, let us know. We're over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and we look forward to your joining the conversation.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks, Kirk.
Thank you, Fred. Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.